I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Yesterday, it became public that 26 men who work at Champlain Orchards in Shoreham have all tested positive for COVID-19. These orchard workers live together and are all in Vermont on the annual work visas from Jamaica to work the autumn apple harvest. One more test out of the 101 conducted over the weekend has now come back positive, bringing the total to 27. The orchard owner says these employees all recently completed their required quarantine, but questions remain about how they contracted the virus and what their living conditions are like that allowed for such rapid and widespread viral transmission. We're going to talk about that situation today, and then we'll also tackle other health issues in our weekly health update. We are joined for the full hour by Dr. Mark Levine, Vermont's health commissioner. Dr. Levine, welcome back to the show. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay.
I hear, like me, you struggle to find time to eat lunch between the press conference and Vermont Edition, so you can also let us know what healthy tips for food you have when you're doing 3 hours worth of on-air work. And we're also joined here at the start by Julia Doucette, outreach nurse for the Open Door Clinic. That's a free Middlebury-based health clinic for those without insurance or who are underinsured. And she's actually been at the orchard this morning checking on the status of the people who've tested positive and those around them and handing out COVID kits, which we can talk a little bit more about. Julia Doucette, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us on Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me.
So let me start with you, Julia, because you've been on the ground in Shoreham today talking with people and getting a sense of what the needs are, what the concerns and questions are for the men who've tested positive, but perhaps as well for those who haven't tested positive and would like to remain virus-free. So what can you tell us about what you were doing this morning?
So this morning I went out to connect with the farm owner and to hand out, as you referred to, as COVID kits. And those are packages of supplies that will go to each of the bunkhouses. There are currently 5 separate houses. 3 are bunkhouses where the workers are staying. And each of these kits, as you said, contains a thermometer, a pulse oximeter, which is a device that's used to check on your oxygen saturation. And that's a really important piece of catching respiratory failure early. And hand sanitizer, a surface disinfectant, a whole bunch of masks, some ibuprofen, and then a bunch of information from the CDC and the Vermont Department of Health about COVID symptoms, information about the Open Door Clinic if they have questions, and just reaching out and making sure people know that we are here to answer questions for them.
You mentioned there are 3 bunkhouses where workers live, but that there are 5 houses or buildings that you were checking on. What are the other 2?
So right now they're just houses that they're using for quarantine, so they're able to separate out 5 of the people who may be at risk but who have not yet tested positive.
I see.
But
so
who had closer contact with the positive cases.
And so from your perspective, what you were observing and witnessing, does it appear that people are effectively and efficiently quarantined so that those who do not have the virus are not exposed to those who do, and those who may have the virus are not exposed to either?
Absolutely. The farm owners have done an amazing job. Their first workers arrived in March, and they have been able to kind of pod their workers into people who live and work and eat together, who are separate from the other pods, some who arrived in June and some who arrived in September. So, you know, people who live in the Shoreham community may have seen workers out and about walking to the grocery store. Those were not the workers who were in quarantine. I believe you said earlier that when workers arrived, they spent 2 weeks in quarantine in their houses before they were allowed out and about.
Dr. Levine, are all 27 positive cases contained only to the men who came here most recently in September?
So that was a cohort of 29, and I believe, with the exception of one individual, that they are all part of the same cohort. And the one individual actually lived in a another part of the property, but was involved with driving the workers to various parts of the orchard.
So from your estimation, Commissioner, did the quarantine process work effectively?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, you know, this is the last group of workers that we're aware of coming into the country for 2020.
To Vermont,
yes. Everyone has been very compliant up until this point with similar quarantine processes. So the reality is the quarantine is a successful intervention for a state to exercise.
It seems sort of half effective if you consider that the cohort that quarantined together, it appears, have not, at least so far, spread the virus outside of that cohort. On the other hand, if they're all quarantining together in very close quarters, what it appears that we've seen is that there is tremendous viral spread within and among this particular small population, which isn't good.
Absolutely. No, they're, in this sense, they're behaving somewhat like a nursing home or a correctional facility where, again, people are housed together. And some people use the cruise ship analogy where, you know, they are all there in one place. So if a virus that is highly contagious does take hold, you're correct that you would hope that you could find the earliest case early enough so that you could then successfully quarantine the remainder of them in a different location and not have as many people become infected.
Without revealing any private details, Julia Doucette, can you tell us a little bit about how the 27 men who've tested positive are doing?
I would say they have a lot of questions, but they are by and large feeling good. They continue to be healthy. They really run a spectrum in terms of age. So some are on the younger side, some are on the older side who may have underlying conditions. But I would say, by and large, the biggest question was, when can we be out of quarantine?
You said there are a lot of questions. Does that also incorporate some fear? Or are they mostly just those practical questions about when can I get back to work?
No, there's definitely, for those who tested positive, I think there are a lot of questions about what does this mean? What is my risk? How can I protect myself? What can I do at home? For those who have tested negative, those are the ones who are really wondering, one, when are they out of the woods? And two, when can they get out of quarantine?
What do their healthcare options look like should they need any more advanced medical care than the COVID kits that you've been distributing, Julia?
So that is something that is in the works. We as the clinic have been in touch with Porter Hospital and the Vermont Department of Health looking into different options for collaboration and coverage in terms of making sure that these guys receive access to health care that they need. As you can imagine, they're a fairly vulnerable population in that they don't have a lot of access to transportation. They're not covered by any health care coverage, health insurance coverage. And they often come without a full understanding of what our health care system looks like and how to access care. So our job is really to work with the farm owners and as much as possible work with the farm workers to connect them to the best way to get them the help that they need.
Are you confident that they'll be able to get and afford, you know, not be so financially compromised that it's going to just, you know, wreck them, that they will be able to get this kind of health care if they need it, Julia?
Absolutely. Porter Hospital is, there is a type of funding through the federal government, through the Health Resources and Services Administration, that is specifically for COVID treatment and testing for those who are uninsured. We've had success in the past with Porter accessing that fund, and I feel, I would say, fairly confident that that would happen again in this circumstance. I also know that there are financial assistance applications or programs for people without insurance, and those can often lead to, it's a sliding fee scale, so that can lead to 100% coverage depending on the patient's household size and income.
Dr. Levine, Julia mentioned that one of the main questions she was hearing this morning was, when can I get back to work? And I imagine that part of that is a drive and a determination to work, but also may be somewhat motivated by concerns about financial implications if they're not working. And you know, is the state looking into how to address this particular concern? You know, many of us who are employed through other types of businesses may be able to take advantage of federal COVID paid time off or an ability to still maintain a salary while being home because of health concerns or COVID related concerns. That may not be true, certainly for all workers throughout our society, but particularly for this sector of our working economy. So how can we financially assist or protect these workers if they're out of work for 2 weeks or more?
Yeah, no, those are great questions. You know, as H-2A workers, these employees are very accustomed to earning their money and quite often wiring it back home to families, etc. So it's at the top of their minds as well. The Agency of Agriculture is actually working with business owners to ensure that they can get access to grant funds from the Families First Act. And that apparently provides reimbursement for up to 80 hours of sick leave if you have to isolate or quarantine. So these workers would all be eligible for that sick leave time because they're employed for a long enough time by the orchards and other employers in this country.
So they should be getting sick leave, sick pay.
Not as of today, but obviously they will get it, yeah. The process is underway to get them these grant funds.
Yeah,
it's a little out of my purview because I'm in the Department of Health, and so I'm not aware of everything that the Agency of Agriculture is doing, but this is what they've traditionally done with workers in the past.
Well, and you know, as has come up before, not just in this particular outbreak, but certainly heightened by this outbreak, Commissioner Levine, is this question of, you know, how do we make sure that people are able to get the health care they need, particularly for infectious diseases that could impact other people, rather than holding back for fear of not being able to afford insurance or not being able to take time off work because of, you know, really severe financial considerations. And so while that is not necessarily your charge, I imagine as a public health official, it's something you think about a lot in the way we think about our communities holistically.
Oh, absolutely. As you know, as a public health official, the issue of health equity comes up all the time. And part of health equity is actually not only being able to live in circumstances that can allow you the opportunity to be as healthy as everyone else, but also make sure you have the ability to access the services you need when you need them. The, you know, to pick up on what Julia was saying earlier, there is such a rich tradition in Addison County. It's not like these were the first workers that ever came and the first that ever got ill. So there's such a rich tradition to build upon, both with the Open Door Clinic, opportunity to have people actually visit you, not just visit a clinic, but visit you with regard to immunization opportunities, things of that sort. And with the medical center there, having the access to some federal funds. And I believe they've also had some charitable work that they've done in the past. So if you had to be a guest worker and become ill, I would say Addison County is a great choice to have done that in because of that rich tradition.
We're talking right now about the outbreak in Shoreham at Champlain Orchards, where 27 men have tested positive for COVID-19. They're all here on the guest worker program working in orchards. And what we're hearing from Dr. Mark Levine and from Nurse Julia Doucette is about their status, how they're doing, how they're feeling, what questions they have, as well as how this virus is being contained so far. Listeners, we're going to talk about this for a few more minutes, and then we are going to continue talking about this and other issues throughout the hour. So if you have a question, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or send your questions to Vermont Edition at vpr.org. I have been informed and should mention that Champlain Orchards is a VPR underwriter, so I want to make sure that that's clear to people. And we have a question from Susan, or a note from Susan, who says, I would take this as an opportunity to call attention to the use of migrant and seasonal workers in the state and why they might be more vulnerable due to travel, due to overcrowding and congregate living conditions, perhaps less access to healthcare, language barriers, being uninformed, and so on. What does Vermont do to support and protect them as well as our other city citizens? What do their daily lives look like? Are they working long hours, 7 days a week, eat and sleep together? It sounds difficult. What can we community members do to be supportive? Julia Doucette, that seems like a good question for you.
You know, I wish that there was a quick and easy answer to that comment. I think one of the things to make a distinction is that we do have a fair number of immigrant workers who come to this state to work, whether it be picking vegetables or berries or apples. And we also have workers who are here year-round who work in a lot of our dairies in Vermont and uphold our agriculture in that way. The ways that those two populations live is as different as the way we all live. And so some, yes, live in aggregate housing. Some live two or three to a house, and it really just depends on the farm and the work that they're doing. They are all working hard. They are all doing jobs that many farmers can't find Americans to do, and they really keep the agriculture of Vermont going.
You are meeting a need through the Open Door Clinic. As I mentioned, this is a free health clinic for those without insurance or who are underinsured. And as we've talked about in previous shows over the several years, you know, there are sometimes questions about transportation, making sure that people can actually get to healthcare appointments. So, you know, the Open Door Clinic is meeting a need in the community. Is this the best way, or do you wish there was a different way that the population you serve was able to access health care?
So that's a great question. And I think that we do provide a really important niche. I think we are a safety net for many people who wouldn't otherwise be able to access care. I absolutely think that there would be a way that we could wrap all community members into access, make sure that everybody has access to health care. And I do think that we as a state, as a small state, have an opportunity to be able to do that. And I do think that there are ways to serve everybody. And until that happens, we are here to serve those who need us.
Dr. Levine, what about you?
Oh, I couldn't agree more with everything that Julia has said. I think also that there are times that workers, I'm not saying these workers particularly, but workers would have some perhaps fear or some mistrust of government functions, and having the kinds of services that Open Door provides and others is really essential to overcoming that and providing, if you will, an alternative that is far more accessible and user-friendly, if you will, for that population, which I think is really critical. I do think that you know, the communities that surround the work sites are very familiar with workers. You know, they're used to them being in the area. Not that they're always downtown shopping or what have you, but they're used to seeing them. I think that they're in a very supportive setting because everyone understands the importance to the vibrancy of the economy and the communities they're in of orchards and other farm operations.
We got a question from Elizabeth who says, I'm wondering about the other workers who work at Champlain Orchards but live in Vermont communities and commute. These local workers live and play in surrounding communities and could spread to others, right? Do the other workers have to quarantine if they've been working with the workers who did get infected? Dr. Levine?
So, yes, if they were working that closely with those workers, the answer is yes. But through our contact tracing, we've been able to identify who was at risk and who was not at risk. And the predominant risk was really to the members of the cohort that were the ones that we've been talking about and not widespread throughout the entire operation. Likewise, we've made the announcement, and I'll say it again, that the public is not at greater risk from this either. Things were very much contained, as a quarantine situation, you know, should really be, where there are not going to be a lot of contacts to trace, because most of the contacts are going to be the people that you were quarantining with.
So how many people are currently remaining in isolation or quarantine right now?
Let me do a little math here. There are about 25 people who are in isolation housing, which means they were identified as cases. 5 in on-site quarantine housing.
So, and the difference, there were groups, the difference between there were, those two things are the 25 in isolation are positive
were
cases.
We're the test positives.
Of the 27 five, who have tested positive.
Right. Of the 20, yes. And the 5 who are in on-site quarantine were part of this cohort, but not test positive.
And where are the other two who tested positive but are not included in either of those groups? One is in the hospital?
One is in the hospital.
And the other one?
The math isn't adding up, but I'm sure they're with that group.
Yeah, I mean, it made sense when there were 26 positives yesterday, and if one of those people is in the hospital, then the remaining 25 would be in that living situation. Now that that other test has come back positive, Julia Doucette, do you know perhaps if this person has been moved from the on-site quarantine into that isolated area for positive cases?
I don't.
Okay. Well,
keep in mind the original positive case is not included in the pop-up test results that we did over the weekend because they were already a known positive case.
Got it. And nobody else tested positive other than those original 101 tests. You have
exactly.
All of the test results back, 27 positives out of 101 tests. Is that correct?
That's right. Although, again, it's actually out of 26 out of 100, because the original positive case didn't have to be tested again during the big testing exercise.
Got it. And you're confident, Dr. Levine, that this original person, you've identified who the original case may have come from and that this person contracted the virus outside of Vermont?
Yes, because the entire time they were here, they were in quarantine and they became symptomatic towards the end of the quarantine period.
And is there any concern that this person could have infected other people in transit between Jamaica and Vermont?
Possible, but pretty unlikely, I think, based on the day that symptoms began and counting back.
Julia Doucette, before we let you go, is there anything else that you want community members to know or Vermonters to be aware of or that you'd like to convey to the migrant worker community who may be listening to this and you know, the concerns that many people have about how to protect everybody who lives in Vermont from the virus? Julia? Well, we're going to let Julia think on that. I'll let all Vermonters think on that. It looks like we may have lost her. But Julia Doucette did join us for the first part of the show. She's outreach nurse for the Open Door Clinic, a free Middlebury-based health clinic for those without insurance or who are underinsured. And she was working at Champlain Orchards this morning, connecting with people who work at the orchard to give them COVID kits and other essential information. So we really appreciate Julia Doucette joining us today for the show. Dr. Levine, before we leave this topic of the outbreak at Champlain Orchards, let's go to Guthrie, who's calling in from Putney. Hi, Guthrie. Go right ahead.
Hello. I was actually calling with a question less specifically tied to this event, but more something that I hear on an almost weekly basis referring to the idea that COVID cannot be transmitted through food. And there's actually been seen several reports saying quite the opposite, including one saying that it can linger up to 8 days. So I was wondering if I could get a possible comment on that.
Guthrie, thanks for the question. Dr. Levine, you mentioned in the press conference this morning that Vermonters should not be concerned about apples coming from Champlain Orchards or any other products. And, you know, Guthrie would like some clarity on the potential for the virus to spread through food, contaminated food.
Yeah, I'd like to see some of the data that he's referring to for sure, because bottom line is most of the communication coming out from the CDC and from public health officials is still adhering to the line that food is, if it is a way of transmission, it's got to be a very, very, very minor way, because almost always respiratory pathways are implicated. And even when it comes to touching solid surfaces, that's less than 5% of transmission. So,
is there a distinction to be made between a solid surface, which may or may not be a food surface, and actual contamination in the food?
There is. And it's also, you know, when you touch the solid surface, are you then touching your eyes, your nose, your mouth, your face, versus are you sticking a fork into something and putting it in your mouth and chewing on it and swallowing it? So, again, I can only try to be as reassuring as possible that the data does not support food as being a predominant form of transmission.
So despite the fact that when you open your mouth, you may be breathing or you may be eating, are you saying that actually if somebody, even if there was a virus on the surface of your fork, if you put it in your mouth and swallow it, you're not likely to contract the virus from that action because it's not going through your respiratory system?
That's a good way to look at it. I'm not sure we have it worked out as precisely as you just delineated, but I like that.
But it sounded like that's kind of what you were suggesting, that, yeah, you know, if you're not breathing it in, and I just wonder, you know, if as I take a bite, usually I am also kind of breathing at the same time, although maybe I'm not. Maybe I don't quite understand how my two systems work.
No, you're right. But again, you know, it takes a certain dose of a virus to infect somebody as well. Mm-hmm. So again, I think it's going to be a less predominant form of infection.
We can come back to these questions as they come in, but I want to also address some other questions that listeners have for us. Dunlop writes in to say, I cannot find any drive-through flu vaccination clinics scheduled in Chittenden County. Are drive-through clinics not safer?
To say they're safer would presume that our healthcare system at large is unsafe. And if there's one thing we've proven basically the entire time we've lived under this pandemic, it's that our healthcare system actually is not infecting people with COVID. And it's really great testimony. You know, we reopened the healthcare sector very slowly, started with some outpatient things, moved on to outpatient procedures, and then got into the inpatient setting. And the reality is we were not finding a lot of transmission of disease from the healthcare setting to patients or visitors or anything of that sort. Now, healthcare workers have always had some risk because of the jobs they're doing, working with patients with COVID. But in terms of actually people who go into a hospital with one condition and come out of the hospital having acquired COVID inside the doors, that's just happening here in Vermont. And our outpatient settings where you would get a flu shot, whether they be in the healthcare system or in a pharmacy, are also not being implicated in new cases of COVID-19. So I would just say that there were probably, even if you cannot find a drive-through in Chittenden County, there are many other options that I would regard as very safe. And I wouldn't give up on the idea of a drive-through because we have piloted some in other parts of the state. And what we're doing is essentially partnering with aspects of the healthcare system. So all of our healthcare sites, you know, are getting vaccines shipped to them. And we are providing a lot of guidance and education regarding novel and innovative ways to deliver that vaccine to the people of Vermont. And drive-through is but one of them. So that would still be an option, and it may just not have happened yet. So you could be a little patient during the month of October. I wouldn't want you to wait any longer than that because we really do want to get as much of the population vaccinated this month as we can.
Can you update us on where things stand with the number of flu vaccine doses that have been distributed throughout Vermont? Because the message has been clear, get your flu vaccine. The ability to do that in practice has some Vermonters have felt somewhat hampered by that.
Yeah, you know, I think since the last time this was discussed on your show, they will find that things should have changed because I know of more vaccine that has entered the state and come to practices. I don't have a firm number for you, but I know that we're at least 15% over the amount that we had this time last year, and in terms of what we've been ordering in general, and we have very high goals. So I would hope that we don't hear from a lot of your listeners that if they've tried more recently in the last several days that they're still having trouble finding vaccine accessible to them.
Does that also stand for the vaccine that is administered, the higher dose vaccine administered to senior citizens and the more vulnerable? Because I've also been hearing that some people are really struggling to find that particular type of flu vaccine.
Yeah, the higher dose. I don't know the statistics on that yet to know if we've gotten the ample amount of that compared to the regular, we'll call it, flu vaccine. But I can get back to you with that information.
Yeah, maybe we can address that next week in our health update. Let's go to Jeff, who's calling in from Salisbury. Jeff, go right ahead.
Okay, so I had a very simple question. Living in Addison County, how are these people going to get fed and get their food? So rather than going to the grocery store, is there an alternative that someone take their order, or how does that work?
What can you tell us, Dr. Levine, about how the quarantined workers are actually getting everything they need?
Yeah, so there's one thing we've gotten pretty good at in Vermont. It's how to support the needs of people in quarantine. Because you're right. If you're really strictly abiding by either isolation or quarantine, it means essentially you're not going out to the grocery store. You're not able to, on your own, access food. So either you have somebody delivering it to you or some other arrangement set up. So that's the role of our state Emergency Operations Center, the SEOC, when it's needed, is to be able to provide whatever services are needed, whether it's food, whether it's medications, whether it's other supplies. And I'm not aware that the workers that we're talking about here have had a tremendous need. You know, one thing we were worried about from the start is just the housing need in general. But fortunately, Champlain Orchards had ample amount of housing options that the group would be able to avail themselves of. And you heard from Julia how that's been working out fine. Same thing when it comes to these extra things like food. We're not under the impression that they've needed a lot of extra services, but we're kind of poised and ready to help support that.
And let's go to Kathleen, who's calling in from West Topsom. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Quick question. Those protein spikes that are sticking out of that virus, are those crystalline in form? Are they protein crystals?
Dr. Levine?
Well, that's a great question. They're proteins. I'm not sure about the issue of are they crystals or not.
And we're looking at, are we trying to picture now, you know, that picture of the virus that we've all seen, that's sort of a ball with all of those spiky things on them. That's, I think, what Kathleen is asking about, the spikes on those virus.
Yeah, I've never heard them referred to as crystals, so that would make me think not. But they are, the important aspect to them are that as proteins, they serve as what we call antigens, meaning proteins that our own body's immune system can make antibodies against and trying to fight them off. And that's what part of vaccine development takes into account.
Kathleen, is there a reason that you're asking that or that you're interested in it?
Well, I'm trying to understand a virus. Dr. Levine said some weeks back that the name of the virus was SARS-CoV-2 and that the coronavirus was the illness that it caused. And in my Merck manual, it says that SARS-CoV is genetically dissimilar from known human or animal coronaviruses. And I wondered if that is true, according to this Merck manual, could this, if they are protein crystals, could that be how they are dissimilar?
Hmm. Yeah, I don't think so, to be honest. And just to reiterate your point so the listeners have it, SARS-CoV-2 is the virus. COVID-19 is the illness.
Can I take us down a slight rabbit hole and ask Kathleen why you have a Merck manual? It's just interesting to hear you talk about it.
It's my mother's. She left it to me as a gift. And every time I hear about a virus or an illness, I look it up in my Merck manual because I've been quarantining faithfully for 8 months. And I don't have too much to do but learn about this virus, and this Merck manual is a very big book.
Well, so, Kathleen, how cool.
So I'm sorry?
How cool. Very neat that you have that.
Right. So there's no way I can find out if these proteins are crystals.
Yeah, Dr. Levine, it sounds like, you know, Kathleen really wants to know more about the
yes, I'm making a note to myself to get that information, and we'll get it back to you, Jane.
So, Kathleen, go back to our call screener. You can give our call screener your email address or your phone number, and if we get any more information from Dr. Levine, we'll be sure to pass it along to you, and we'll keep our ears peeled at the press conferences as well. Maybe it will come up another time. Dr. Levine, the president has been taking at least three medical treatments that A, most Americans don't get, and or B, are most often reserved for people with severe cases. Everybody expects that the president of the United States is going to get the country's top medical care. But if the president insists that his case is mild, and yet he's also taking these remarkable therapies and talking them up as a way to beat the virus, do you think that emboldens other Americans to push for drug treatments that aren't tested or aren't medically necessary if they or their loved ones get the virus?
It could embolden a select few, but I would hope that most Americans have faith in those who are caring for them and have a relationship with their healthcare providers that enables trust. And if their own personal clinician doesn't wants to have more expertise and consults other specialties, that they would trust them as well. Because you raise an important point. There are treatments that are effective for a specific illness, but then there are also treatments that are effective for a specific illness in a specific time frame or for a specific group of people with that illness that are defined by certain clinical characteristics, whether it be their oxygen level, whether it be being in an intensive care setting on a ventilator or not, et cetera. And, you know, we try to be good stewards of healthcare resources. And if a treatment has not been shown to be effective in someone who's very mildly impacted by the illness, we try to avoid using it there because, number one, we'd be fooling them to think that there was any efficacy because it hasn't been shown. And number two, because we'd be wasting an important resource that should be reserved for someone who's more ill. So that's the way I would look at this is, you know, he's received three types of drugs. One was this so-called antibody cocktail, which is frankly still in trials. The second is remdesivir, which has been well studied by this point. And the third has been dexamethasone, which has also been reasonably well studied at this point. And they all have specific indications and timeframes for which they should be started. So I would trust those in infectious disease and critical care medicine who would be the ones administering these drugs to the ill population who are hospitalized to make the right decisions with regard to use of them. And, you know, as I heard on the news last night by another prominent physician, this is an N of one study. And an N of one study doesn't teach us a lot about how to utilize specific therapeutics. We really do need to rely on larger trials that are carefully performed and can advise us appropriately.
Sure. But when the N of one patient is the president and he's saying, look at how great the care I got was, you know, I'm going to beat this and so can you. I mean, it's human psychology. This is what all advertising is based on. We think about the ads for medical treatments that say, ask your doctor about this. It could really help you. You know, I think it's reasonable to think that people do trust their medical professionals when and if they have access to medical professionals in this country. However, you know, there are a lot of people who also want then to get the same thing that the president tells them worked for him and could work for them.
Yeah, and I agree. And sometimes when the president is giving the orders, people fall in line and respond appropriately. But when another individual patient without that level of authority in the country dictates to their healthcare provider, they're generally going to get not pushback, but you're going to get education and rationale for why something is or is not being used or should or shouldn't be used.
And you might get a no.
And you might get a no, but and then you could obviously go elsewhere or choose someone else. But the reality is, again, we really base so much of what happens in healthcare on relationships, and those are critical. And most of us don't have that authority to be able to order our people around when we want something, but we do want to listen to them and gain an understanding that they're knowledgeable and are exercising the appropriate judgment in our own specific case.
Let's get it to another question here. Bob is calling in from Burlington. Bob, hi. What's your question?
Yeah. Hi, Jane, Dr. Levine. I was curious if any investigation into the outbreak kind of wrapped around the Bennington golf tournament was indicating if that was a result of any outdoor activity, i.e. the golfing, versus if there was some indoor component to that tournament. Just kind of curious if any further investigations brought any light to the difference of where that might have allowed.
Bob, yeah. I'm glad you brought that up because, boy, that conversation about the golf tournament in Bennington and people in New York and Vermont who tested positive seems like it was 100 years ago, and it was just last week that we were talking about it. So what can you tell us, Dr. Levine?
Yeah, it's sort of really been forgotten about. Well, I can tell you that in the last 2 days of testing, we'll see what today brings. We've not heard of more positive cases from our test sites that are set up down in that area. Yesterday, we did do a more extensive testing at a pop-up. So hopefully those results will be available tonight or tomorrow at the latest. And clearly, we're not seeing a lot of abundant cases compared to where they started. So the bottom line is the investigation is revealing in that we believe someone at the golf tournament was already ill, but may not have been symptomatic. And that's how others were infected. Now, a golf tournament by definition is outdoors. There were, I think, award ceremonies and dining that was also outdoors. I think there was minimal indoor activity. So we usually say outdoors is better, and we continue to say that. But again, if you're outdoors in very close proximity and you're not wearing a mask, like might happen during a cocktail hour or something of that sort, you do need to exercise caution because that would still be an opportunity to contract the virus, even though it would be more likely if that were indoors. So we don't have firm understanding, but we do believe that the cases that we're aware of, which are only a few in Vermont, were contracted predominantly at the golf tournament, most likely outdoors.
Let's squeeze another call in here from Berlin, where Sister Lorian is calling from. Hi, Sister Lorian. Go right ahead.
Hello. I'm concerned, and I've written this down, so I'll say it quickly. Why does the health department not deal with the people who have had COVID, have not died, but have really not recovered? There must be a reason why these people appear to be off your radar. Or maybe, is it because we don't have any of them in Vermont? Why aren't we hearing about that kind of people from the health department?
Sister Lorianne, thank you for the call. And I want to direct people who are interested in this to listen to the show we did on Vermont Edition, I think 2 weeks ago or a week ago now, about what are people who are often called long haulers. And the doctor we had on suggested that as many as 30% of people who contract COVID-19 have long-term lasting effects several months into their illness after they've recovered, presumably from the infectious part of the disease, who are still experiencing all kinds of symptoms. And so we clearly do have them in Vermont. UVM Medical Center is working with many of them, and we heard from even more on the program, and we'll put a link to it at vpr.org. I think it was 2 weeks ago now. But Dr. Levine, there have been questions that come up as well about, you know, the health department data shows the number of people recovered. And I think for some people, they say, I may not have viral transmission, you know, I may not be infectious, but I am far from recovered.
Exactly. That show was very helpful, by the way, because I think we need shows like that to really counter some of the rhetoric that is coming out of Washington, because there are many that are not believing that COVID could be serious. Now, admittedly, we might have been part of the problem because in the beginning we said, well, 80% of people are going to do fine. It's only 20% who are really going to have a rockier course. And we still believe that. But of course, in the beginning, you don't know what's going to happen to an individual patient 3, 4, 5 months later. And that's where our data isn't satisfactory yet either, because we assume that at 1 month, if you've lost all of those initial symptoms and you're not having fevers, that you are recovered. And that's the definition of that term. But it doesn't mean you're not going to become what you've termed a long hauler. And that's where we really need to collect a lot more data. And that's not just the Vermont Department of Health. That's going to be nationwide where we really, really need to collect this data to get a sense for how much sequela is there to having been infected by coronavirus. We do know that so many people do have a mild illness or may only have a positive test and no illness, and they don't seem to be suffering a lot long term. But those who have a general infection, we should be very concerned about, and we should try to get a handle on exactly what is the nature of their symptoms, what organs are having significant stress or dysfunction, and do these symptoms eventually go away, or do they become like other syndromes we've seen, like chronic fatigue syndrome, for instance, where people have very long-term symptoms, perhaps triggered by a viral infection, but we don't always have one that we could identify. So very important question that your listener is asking, and we're going to have a lot more data over the course of this pandemic to really answer it effectively.
Just in 10 seconds, is that work that the health department is doing, or are you relying on other studies to get that kind of data?
Right now, we're relying on the scientific literature to get that data. But I could perceive it as something that the health department might become interested in and try to get some CDC funding to accomplish.
Well, Dr. Levine, thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk with us and to answer questions. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Dr. Mark Levine, Health Commissioner for the state of Vermont. And we do a weekly health update pretty much every week. So if you have health questions that weren't answered today, you can continue to send them to Vermont Edition at vpr.org.